Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and it should be obvious by now that Ann Haig has laryngitis.
Ann Haig swallowed a frog. probably a very large toad by the sound of it.
But we were visiting our grandchildren, and I woke up and said to my six-year-old grandson, Nana has lost her voice. And Philip said, Nana, did you look in your suitcase? And his little temple flashed.
Yeah, but as they say in show business, the show must go on.
Exactly.
So Miss Ann is right here, side by side with three excellent interviews for you in today's program. So we're glad you joined us. Pleased that you're with us this particularly exciting Sunday morning. It's sadly it is the month of December, and in our neck of the woods, as Al Roker would say, it's rather cold and chilly. It feels like fall. When we were away in South Carolina for Thanksgiving, it was bright and sunny. So why are we here? We're here because we need to be here in order to bring you a new program. So we're so glad you joined us. And kicking off today's program
is the New York Times' fabulous Florence Fabricant. And I love her, I don't even know if you'd call it a nickname, Flo Fab, which is her username, I guess. Flo Fab is just that. And she's going to be talking to us about an also equally fabulous book called City Harvest, which features some of your most absolutely admire top celebrity chefs and their recipes. So let's hear Florence Fabricant.
Florence Fabricant has been a bellwether of food trends, and as well as a number of other issues related to chefs and restaurants. She is probably best known for her columns in the New York Times. But something I didn't know, Florence, is that you also are the author of 11 cookbooks.
This is number 12.
Oh, wow. Okay. And the book that we're talking about, Florence Fabricant, is City Harvest, 100 Recipes from Great New York Restaurants. And tell me, I was asking you off air, and now maybe you could repeat, but there are a gazillion different hunger relief organizations, including Share Our Strength, all across the country. But the one best known and iconic one is City Harvest in New York City.
Well, it started at a time when there were not so many hunger relief programs, for one thing. So it filled a need. It filled a need in two directions. Number one, it filled a need for feeding the hungry, particularly homeless people who could now find a soup kitchen more easily. And it filled a need on the part of chefs and caterers and even people who make, who film commercials or grocery stores.
That's interesting, yeah.
To find a good use for perfectly presentable, edible food that they had no use for. So they would find this use as a way to feed the hungry. And the elegance of this equation is so perfect that it's one of these, oh, why didn't I think of that sooner?
Right, exactly. And it started in 1982, I believe. Right,
and it's been replicated all over the world. When it started, it was really a first. And even when it started, chefs were not besieged the way they are now to contribute to this, that, and the other thing. And it was a way for them to be very satisfied with the fact that they are giving back without any kind of huge effort on their part and without shelling out money, without donating meals and tables and cooking classes and whatnot. It was just simple and great, and it still is.
Yeah.
Now, who came up with the idea to begin with, Florence?
Who came up with it? I'm not sure.
You're not sure, okay.
But you have a gangbuster board of directors, don't you?
Well, I'm not involved in the organization in any kind of substantive way, except for having written this book. So I, you know, in terms of the ins and outs of who's running the organization and so forth, I can't help you there, but I can tell you that virtually all the top chefs are very much involved. And Eric Repair, who's at the top of the top, is one of the chef leaders, the culinary council of City Harvest, and he has taken a very active role. And with his name there, it's easy to recruit other chefs.
Well, you must have had a difficult time with all these people involved with the organization in selecting or choosing who to invite and then selecting the chefs for this book, since you were limited to 100.
Well, it wasn't as difficult as you think, because first of all, I got a list of the chefs who were involved in City Harvest. That was the easy part. And then people from City Harvest took care of contacting them and requesting from each the names of two recipes they would contribute. Not the actual recipes, just the names of two recipes. Okay. And with that in hand, I was able to sort through and construct the cookbook in terms of a group of appetizers, soups, main courses, desserts, etc., so that there wouldn't be a huge amount of duplication, right, and there'd be enough variety. And then, with that in hand, we requested actual recipes. When the recipes came in, there were some that called for sous vide or very obscure ingredients or too many steps and whatnot that were just out of the question. So it was it sort of narrowed itself down to the 100 recipes. There were not too many that I received that I didn't use.
Well, I must say this. I said off air again that I'm so glad that you, such an established and experienced pro, were the one that got to write this book, because let's face it, chef's recipes are not always the easiest things to turn around to be accessible for the home cook.
Well, there are often garnishes, condiments made in-house, and that kind of thing, which I would either eliminate or simplify in great measure. For example, there was a strawberry confit required for Daniel Hum's strawberry gazpacho. The whole notion of strawberry gazpacho had me scratching my head, and once I tried the recipe, I saw it was really terrific. But to have the home cooks then first make this strawberry confit, I said no. Out it went. There was a gooseberry garnish and Daniel Boulud's squash soup. Another nice touch, but under the circumstances, not something that one had to demand. So it was things like that I managed to eliminate, and was in a great measure how I could simplify the recipes.
Now, one of the things you did in every recipe, whether you did or the chefs did, I'm not sure, but there are cooking tips that are really, I guess, in addition to the ingredients and the instructions, the real tip as to how to make it work. I noticed, for example, on the strawberry gazpacho, which is, I thought was an unusual choice too, that you said, or whoever did this said, don't do this when strawberries are out of season because they don't taste any good.
Well, the tips were mine.
Okay, yeah. Good.
They're called cook's notes, and I think that that's one of the most enlightening parts of this book. That what
and
you explain.
Also, each recipe comes with a little another tip called second helpings.
Yeah, I got that.
And often it's a way to use leftovers. And I felt that was also my idea, and I felt that given the nature of City Harvest, it was appropriate.
Right.
So nothing goes to waste.
Right. Did you test all these recipes yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Wow, that's a major operation. How long did this whole thing take?
Well, I did very serious testing and cooking over about 4 months.
That's not bad, actually, considering. So you broke it down into these different divisions. Do you have favorites in here?
Do I? Yes.
Okay. How about telling us what they might be?
Well, for example, right off the bat, the second recipe is the Russian eggplant from Ellen Kay's.
Oh, I like that. Yeah.
She had sent in a recipe that called for 4 whole eggplants, so you could be eating Russian eggplant year-round for 3 years. But I cut that down, but it's a terrific recipe. It's sort of like Baba Ganoush, but not. Yeah. And I was very taken with that recipe. It's something that I've made since then because, well, I like it.
Yeah, I intend to make it. It popped out at me, too. Let's get to, you mentioned Ellen Kay's as the chef here. One of the things I noticed going in here is there's a diverse mix of some of the big shining stars like Eric Repair, you have Danielle in here as well. I mean, there are a bunch of them, but you also mix in a lot of more casual places.
Well, yeah, there's kind of a balance here. And across the board diversity, I think that was important.
Uh-huh. Now, we said that a portion of the money goes to Just Harvest. Are people buying this as a way to help with fundraising, or are they buying it for the recipes?
We have no idea, but yeah, we hope people will be inspired to buy it because the proceeds do go to City Harvest.
Right. Well, I mean, the recipes themselves are pretty good, too. What are some of your other favorites?
There's the David Boulay recipe, which is called Forager's Treasure of Wild Mushrooms. I had had the dish at Boulay and thought it was fabulous. And he sent in this recipe, and I said, oh, my God, how is anyone going to do this? It called for all kinds of different mushrooms and so forth. But then as I started to work with it, I saw it really wasn't that difficult. It was mainly a shopping demand to get as many different kinds of mushrooms as you possibly could. And frankly, today there are websites online where you can buy fresh mushrooms of all sorts. So it turned out it's just a very unique and alluring mixture of mushrooms with a sauce that's got some black truffle paste in it, which is, you know, puts it on the high end, but it's not an impossible challenge at all. And, you know, on the other hand, you've got Rao's Restaurant's meatballs, which couldn't be simpler and are also downright delicious.
Yeah. Now, you also cover a lot of history of restaurants, I was kind of surprised, and of chefs in your head notes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, you condensed the whole development of Batard in one paragraph.
Well, yeah, you know, space is a consideration, and you've got to write to space. I'm used to that from the newspaper.
Well, that's true, too.
Well, less is more anyway. If you're writing about one of Drew's restaurants, less can be more sometimes. That's a story for another day, I guess.
Right.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is a good recipe, too. The Parmesan risotto is a good recipe.
Yeah, and then there's a very simple recipe for pasta with anchovies. I mean, it really couldn't be simpler. It's almost like, a cacio e pepe sort of spaghetti with butter and anchovies.
You're picking out all these recipes that I noticed, too, when I read the book. But you mentioned that this recipe was not really authentically Roman, and boy, it sure sounds it, doesn't it?
Yeah. And then I made the macaroni and cheese, which is kind of complicated, with my granddaughters. And they decided this was the best macaroni and cheese they'd ever eaten.
Is this Murray's Cheese Cafe?
Yeah.
Yeah. What makes it special? I'm not an aficionado of the mac and cheese.
Well, I think that the combination of cheeses at the end of the day is what gives it its character. Uh-huh. And then you bake it with the panko crumbs on top. Uh-huh. The other recipe that is a job and a half but worth it is Harold Moore's coconut cake.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, is it Commerce, his restaurant, right?
Yeah, but that restaurant has closed.
Oh, it has, okay.
But I'm glad that that's what happens. You write a book about restaurants and a few of them no longer exist by the time the book comes out.
Now, did he resurface anywhere yet?
He's now at a place near Lincoln Center called More Food and Wine.
Okay, great. Because we had dinner with him at Commerce and we really enjoyed it. And
his food is really good.
Right.
That's the secret, isn't it? When the end of the day comes around, that's really the secret.
Yeah.
I did think it was interesting that Aldo, you selected Aldo Sohm to not only have one, but actually have two recipes.
Yeah.
They're really Eric Repair's recipes.
Yeah. Right.
they're sneaky Eric Repair recipes.
Yeah. They're from the Aldo Sohm Wine Bar, but they're Eric's recipes.
Yeah, you have some really interesting dessert things. I don't pay a lot of attention to dessert, and I should, I guess. Because, red wine poached figs with black pepper, and I think that's great. I just don't have a sweet tooth, so I haven't paid that much attention to it. So if you break it out into a separate section like this, I pay attention to it and the bakery or the chef that's made it.
Yeah.
And I guess you can't do a cookbook even today without doing cocktails. So you have cocktails as well.
Right, right. And I love the Harry Lime for a bar called The Third Man. I mean, it's just perfect.
Yeah, that's pretty witty, huh? A lot of people, unfortunately, probably don't even remember
the Third Man.
and if they did, they don't remember who starred in it.
Right.
My recollection, it was Orson Welles.
Yes.
Well, Florence, you've really been very enlightening, and the book, I think, is something that people should have and use. And I think that it is good. It's perfectly possible to use this easily and with enthusiasm. It's published by Rizzoli. It's City Harvest is the name of the book.
And I think it's available on the City Harvest website, cityharvest.org.
It would be.
It's available through our website as well. It's available through innumerable websites.
Right.
I have a secret.
And it's a great gift.
Can I let out the little secret about your name?
Yeah.
American Athletics has its Flojo. But American dining criticism and cooking has its flow fab.
I love that. That's, yeah.
Flow fab, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Well, it was lovely chatting with you, and enjoy cooking from this book.
Yeah, I mean, why would you not? It's really a very wonderful, successful book. Thank you, Florence.
My pleasure.
And then go away, because we'll be right back with another great lady of the culinary arts.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Now, when we talk to a lot of interesting people in the food world, we also meet some that are the nicest. And one of the nicest has to be Sarah Foster, who we've interviewed before. And here we interview her about her latest book, which is a really useful cookbook called Foster's Market Favorites. Happy 25th anniversary to Sarah Foster and Foster's Market. Sarah, you've had a charmed life in the food business. Tell us a little bit about how you ended up there. We're going to be talking, by the way, of your book, your latest one called Foster's Market Favorites. Although we've interviewed you before about at least one of your other books. How many do you have now?
This is my fifth cookbook, and this, as you said, is our 25th anniversary
collection, so I'm very excited about it.
Now, you started out in Tennessee, but ended up in the Great Triangle in North Carolina, huh?
Yeah, I grew up in Tennessee, and then when I got out of school, I went to New York and went to cooking school, and I was in New York in the Connecticut area for a number of years. And then I moved to North Carolina in Durham and opened Foster's Market.
Now, I want to say, you know, kudos to your dear husband for writing the introduction to your book. Not many spouses do that.
Well, I have to say, I don't know if you've had a chance to read it or not, but everyone that reads it says it's one of their favorite parts of the book.
Oh, it's great. I read it.
Oh, good. Yeah. So it really gives you a good background to my history and how I got started out cooking professionally. The only problem with it was the first round he did it, we really had to edit it. It was really, really long.
Oh, that's typical of people who are not professional writers, actually. It's harder to write short.
It turned out really well.
Oh, it did.
Now, we should put in a quick note here that Sarah's husband is the other Peter Sellers.
Yeah.
Yes, he is the other Peter Sellers.
Just as I am, and this is a really obscure one for the ages. I don't think Anne even knows that, if I even ever mentioned it. But I'm the other Peter Haig. During the time I was growing up, there was a newscaster on the BBC whose name was Peter Haig, and we're clearly not related if you ever look up a picture of him, because he was bald and had a big black mustache.
And that can have its advantages and disadvantages, right, of having someone else's name?
Oh, yes.
I'm guessing so, but this was a brilliant performer, and you know, sadly, and probably rather correctly, that in fact the great comedian Peter Sellers is not as well known as he used to be.
Well, everybody slips away. Reminds me of my friend who was teaching an art history course at Carnegie Mellon University. And I was considering teaching it, and he said, well, it wasn't that I was surprised to know that nobody in the class had heard of Lord Nelson, but I was a little surprised when nobody had ever heard of Napoleon.
Oh, my goodness.
Anyhow, back to Foster's Market favorites. It is such a handsome book.
Well, thank you. It's
the 25th anniversary. You've done so many things, and you've had a lot of influences. Clearly, the Southern influence permeates your book. But you spent a lot of time working with them. What is her name?
Martha Stewart.
I worked for Martha before she became Martha. Well, she had a catering business in Connecticut, and I was the chef in her catering business for years. So we had a lot of fun together. I learned a tremendous amount from her. She was actually the baker for the catering business, so she used to make all the beautiful wedding cakes, and we would do these huge parties in New York for thousands of people, and the decorations were always so elaborate and so beautiful. So it was really a lot of fun working for her, and a great experience.
Well, she must have had a lot more patience than her reputation implies.
Well, I think you have to have patience to be a baker.
I think so, too.
I'm more of a cook than a baker, I say. I'm not too great at measuring exact ingredients. I like to go with the flow a little bit.
Yeah, but weighing them all now.
Well, now there was an interesting observation that Peter Sellers put in his introduction. At one point, he said you came to him and you said, "I'm going back south. Are you coming?"
We had both been living in Connecticut and working in New York, and we were just kind of tired of the whole metropolitan area, and we were looking for something a little calmer and a little quieter and somewhere we could raise our horses. We had, at that time, we had three horses, and I realized one day we were paying more to board our horses than we were for our mortgage, so... It was time to start looking somewhere where we could buy property and we lived on a farm in North Carolina for about 20 years, so that was really nice. At one point, we even grew vegetables and flowers for the market.
Well, you know, I think if people expect this book to be straightforward, classic, Southern cuisine, they'll be in for a shock.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think that's a great thing about coming to Foster's Market is, and one thing really too that has kept us going for 25 years is there's always something new there. And even though this book has a few recipes that are our favorites, you know, things that we've been making for 25 years, like our tarragon chicken salad, our scones, it has a lot of new recipes.
Or the pimento thing, whatever that, pimento spread. What
pimento cheese, yes, pimento that's definitely cheese. A southern thing.
But well, you have to make that, right?
I guess. Yeah. I mean, our kids live in South Carolina, so we've been exposed to pimento cheese.
There are a lot of other great recipes in the book, too, that are, you know, I think they have southern influence sometimes because of the ingredients, but definitely a much broader influence on the general book of cooking.
Yeah, you have Middle Eastern, you have Mediterranean in general influences, so that until you actually approach every single recipe, you won't get the full idea of the scope of your talent here. I mean, I'm looking at your pork tenderloin with olives and tangerines. Now, that's not southern, is it?
Well, that is actually a great dish, and I love the combination of the tangerines and the olives together. You get that sweet and salty mix, which I think goes so well with pork.
Now, you obviously like some of these recipes. I imagine you wouldn't be making them if you didn't. So what are some of your favorites?
Well, some of my favorites and probably some of the ones that I use most often are the recipes that are in the sides and the salads chapter. To me, I'm the person that goes in a restaurant and I'll order my entree based on what the side is that comes with it.
So, oh, wow.
One of the standards I love, and I did two versions of this, is there's a big platter of roasted vegetables and a big platter of grilled vegetables. And it's such an easy recipe, and it goes well with most anything. And it's something that you can make in the seasons. And a lot of these recipes, I give you seasonal variations. So in the winter, like this time of year, your roasted vegetables might be things like carrots and potatoes and winter squash, like acorn squash or butternut squash. And in the summer, it might be more summery things like yellow squash and zucchini and peppers and okra and more of the summer vegetables, tomatoes and things like that. But I just love all the sides and the salads in this book, and a lot of great things with all the grains that are available now, like quinoa and farro.
Oh, yes.
And barley and all those things that, you know, I think we use more now than we have in the past.
And now, I mean, you have a few historical notes or little, you know, headers, like an egg sardou your way. I mean, I've made egg sardou for a million years. In fact, it's become like a joke in our family. But I never know where they came from. Tell us that.
Well, they came from New Orleans, so the egg sardou your way are based on what you want to put on them. Basically, it contains several different elements. You have eggs that are usually poached, and then you have a bed of something to put them on. In this case, it's spinach and artichokes, which I really love this version of them. And then you have a nice sauce, and for my recipe, it's a sriracha hollandaise sauce, which I think just goes really well with the spinach and the artichokes.
Well, it certainly makes them different, putting the sriracha in there. It modernizes
the
whole dish.
Sriracha gives it a really nice little spice.
And you have Korean barbecue in here?
Yeah, we have a Korean barbecue chicken, and barbecue ribs are made with like a sriracha honey barbecue sauce. So there are a lot of different spices and a lot of different influences, like you said, that are in this book. It's really a collection of a great collection of recipes.
Now, here's an interesting picture called Make Your Own Sandwich Board. And I noticed something interesting on the way through, because I think Ann told me that in the introduction, is it Peter says, You say Peter likes this particular brand of mustard?
Oh, Peter loves yellow mustard.
he likes yellow mustard because I saw and was leaping through here, and I saw this little jar on the way through of Coleman's English mustard.
Yeah, well,
which I absolutely love. I mean, there are some things that only English mustard should go with.
Yeah, I like the Coleman's because it's so spicy. But the make your own sandwich board's a great idea that you can do when you have weekend guests or you have people over for lunch. And the idea is to just kind of put out a spread of different things, a lot of the things you might have in your refrigerator, like your condiments, like mustard and mayo and pickles. And then you can slice some things like avocados and red onions. And then you could have a selection of different meat and cheese, maybe like turkey and salami or turkey and ham and several different kinds of cheese, and just kind of let people mix and match their own things and make their own sandwich. And it's easier for you, and that way your guests get involved and they can pick and choose what they like.
Right. Now, I'm trying to find, when I was leafing through the book earlier, you have sauces, a whole lineup of sauces that will elevate your cooking.
So that is at the end of the family dinner chapter. And the idea of that, I mean, if you guys are like me, a lot of nights I get home from work and I kind of go to my standard, which is a boneless, skinless, grilled, or kind of pan sauteed chicken breast.
Yeah.
And just
don't
because it's so easy to cook, and I feel like that it you can do a lot of things with it. And so giving you the idea of all the different sauces, it completely changes that boring chicken uh-huh. breast by elevating it to a new level, you know, with the sauce. And some of these things are a little more involved than the others, but
they're all very modern, though. I mean, I think that it speaks to how current your attitudes are about food, such as you have sriracha, again, in an aioli. Aioli's been around for years, but now it's coupled with sriracha.
Yeah, and then some of my favorites are the buttermilk yogurt salts with the different variations. And most of us have yogurt in our refrigerator, I think, today. And if you don't have buttermilk, you should definitely always have buttermilk in your fridge.
You know,
so
I
much
mean,
you can do with it, and it lasts forever.
I had one place that really had the real cultured, real buttermilk, and they went out of business. And now I don't know where to get it.
Oh, that's really good. But so the buttermilk yogurt sauce, some of the variations are things that you might also have in your pantry or your spice drawer. So there's a variation that's just herbs and fresh lemon juice and a little bit of garlic. And then we do a south of the border variation that has cilantro and cumin and chipotle peppers. Or you can do a curry variation that has curry powder and a little bit of sweet chutney. Or a harissa variation, and this is probably the one I've been using the most often.
Because people
fell in love with harissa. It goes so well with not only chicken, but the other night I made meatballs with lamb, and I just made a harissa yogurt salts to go with them, and it just tasted so good with the lamb meatballs. You know, it has that cooling effect. It just makes everything very cool and refreshing.
And, you know, 15 years ago, you wouldn't get anybody to buy it.
Yeah, if you even knew what it was or where to buy it.
True.
So I feel like definitely that's a very good point. I feel like we have so many things that are more available us to today than they were even 5 years ago.
I still think that one of the things you do that's interesting, woven all the way through, are some traditional preparations as well. And I was reminded of something I had forgotten about, which is the potatoes they make in Syracuse, New York, and places like that called salts.
Oh, yes.
And you have a recipe for salts, and it calls for an enormous amount of salt. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, we spend a lot of the time in the summer in upstate New York, and like you said, those potatoes are known everywhere there, but you actually buy these potatoes in a bag, and they're called salt potatoes, and they come with a bag of salt that you cook them in.
Okay.
And Peter, my husband, makes these great breakfast potatoes with them, but we don't use all of the salt that comes with them. So, and you can use any, really, any kind of small, kind of waxy potato. Yukon Golds are great. So you kind of parboil the potatoes until they're not completely done. You want them soft enough that you can press them down and flatten them, but you don't want them so soft that when you press on them, they're going to kind of mash, you know, and disintegrate. So you kind of parboil them, and then you take a bottom of a heavy glass or a coffee mug and smash them, and then put them on a baking sheet with olive oil and roast them in a hot oven. Put a little salt and pepper on them, maybe some rosemary if you like, and roast them in a hot oven until they get nice and crispy. And they make the greatest potatoes, not only for breakfast, but we have them for dinner often too.
My stepfather absolutely loved them.
Yeah, it's a great way to, it's a great potato to make.
No, the only time he was here in the United States with my mother was in 1979, and it was the day after the Pirates had just won the World Series from the Baltimore Orioles, and we were in Syracuse, New York, and we ordered these off the menu, and he absolutely loved them. It was such a delight. It brought back the memory to see them in your cookbook.
Oh, well, good. Well, I hope you're going to make them sometime soon.
Yeah,
well,
he's a good potato cooker.
Yeah, I now have a recipe, so I'll definitely do that.
Now, you have something that we're interested in is explaining the difference between polenta and grits.
Yes. So, well, in the South, we serve grits, and in Italy, they serve polenta. And I just actually did this yesterday in a cooking class. To me, they're kind of one and the same.
Yeah, well, that's what I think, too. But Southerners don't usually think that.
Yeah, it's really just cornmeal that has been ground, and usually the grind of the polenta is a little finer than the grind of the grits. So many different varieties of grits these days
that's the one to
try both and interchange them and see if you notice a real difference.
Okay, we have another category that it would not be your cookbook, it would not be worthwhile anniversary cookbook without, and that is really over-the-top desserts. Peter's drooling over.
Well, I said at the beginning of our conversation, we put on 500 calories a piece and we didn't even eat anything.
We looked at the picture of your Foster's brownies.
Yeah, doesn't that look amazing? So the brownies we make at Foster's, and these brownies are not very chocolatey and a little bit fudgy. And
they
often, often when I have guests to dinner and I don't feel like making desserts, I will bring home brownies from Foster's Market and serve them with ice cream and some kind of nice jarred sauce to go on top.
This is caramel.
Yeah, it has the dulce de leche sauce on top.
Oh, okay. And it
delicious.
Looks like nothing.
But it's such I feel like people really, it's an unexpected dessert for people because it's so homey and comforting, and they really don't expect you to serve brownies and ice cream. It's kind of decadent, too, but, oh, my goodness, everyone loves it.
Well, of course they do.
Yeah, we got a caramel sauce from a place called Fat Toad.
Oh, it's good.
Uh-huh.
And that is absolutely insane. I eat it out of the jar when there are no brownies available to spoon it over.
No,
is that
me.
The one they make with goat's milk?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Yes, I love that. That's so good. We sell that at Foster's, too.
I thought maybe you might.
Uh-huh. It's delicious.
Well, everybody, go ahead.
The great thing I think about brownies, too, and the other thing that I think has changed in the food world is we all have so many great stores in our area that are available, you know, that make great things like brownies and cookies. And I encourage people to entertain and have people over to your home, but don't feel like you have to do every single aspect of the meal. It's okay to buy cookies and add some ice cream and, you know, keep part of your meal simple, because otherwise if you try to make every single...
You lose your mind, yeah.
Yes, every single part of the dinner, you know, you spend your time stressing over it, and then you get to the point where you don't enjoy it. So it's So it's okay to buy things sometimes.
Now, Sarah Foster, this is, explain, people can come into Foster's Market, and where are you exactly?
I'm in Durham, North Carolina, and we have a website, fostersmarket.com.
So that's where they can find out exactly where you are in Durham, right?
Yeah, and if you're ever in our area, please come by and see us.
And people who come there can buy things to take out. They can buy pantry items. They can have breakfast, lunch
and dinner.
And brunch, and mains as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're open 7 days a week, from 7:30 a.m. to 8 p.m. So yeah, we serve lunch all day. You can come in any time of day and get a sandwich, and we make homemade soups.
Oh, it sounds heavenly. I wish you were in my neighborhood.
Well, you'll have to come visit. You guys said you go on the road often.
Yeah, I know. We haven't been to Durham for ages. Sarah Foster, congratulations on the quality you've maintained for 25 years, as well as your longevity, and for this beautiful cookbook.
And please say hello to my namesake.
I will. Thank you, Ann and Peter, for having me on.
Thanks, Sarah.
I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it, too. Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And closing out today's program, a gentleman who's a real expert in his field, and I'll intro to him briefly in just a moment. The one thing I will have to say is, if you can't get your dough right after reading this book, then you're really in trouble, because he's a real expert, right, sweetheart?
Yes, I mean, we're talking about Russell Van Kranenburg, and it's called Making Dough, and he figures out the top doughs that you need to know how to do to make perfect pastries. And I'm hoping the spirit moves me to be able to do just that in the holidays season. Russell Van Kranenburg is not a mathematician, but he actually takes the subject of making dough, which is the title of his, and presents it in very lucid mathematical terms so that all of us pastry-challenged individuals can attack even the most difficult of recipes. Thank you for this book. I learned so much just reading it, Russell.
Well, thank you very much, and that's what I like to hear. That's the whole purpose of the book, absolutely.
Started reading in the front of it where you just have explanations under the general title of Getting Started. And I learned so many things, like who knew that flour got rancid and had a shelf life? And after talking to you, I've decided that 15-year-old flour has to be tossed.
Yes. That's definitely a good thing. Maybe should have been tossed about 14 years ago. But
and you know, I didn't understand the significance of sugar absorbing moisture, and it has this other function besides just sweetening.
Oh, absolutely. It's going to give color to a crust. It's going to help extend the shelf life. It really does perform so many different tasks.
I thought the funniest part about it is it feeds the yeasty boys, right?
Oh, yeah. It's funny to think of them as little organisms that eat.
Yeah, absolutely. And,
No, we don't.
that's about all they do. Huh?
They just devour sugar.
Those little yeast buggers, huh?
I think I know people like that, too.
They also have an important function. They take sugar and they make it into alcohol.
Yes.
That's another clever trick.
Yeah. Let's just start with your definition of dough, because that really defines what this book is.
Yes. Yeah, and so in the world of baking, there are so many different things that you can make, but I wanted to narrow it down, and I wanted to kind of stick with dough. And I say that's anything that's a kind of a combination of flour, a liquid fat, sugar, and eggs, and something that you can work with your hands. I think that's really what makes up a dough, because they all have so many different textures and qualities to them, and using your hands is a great way to see if you're on the right track.
Yeah, I mean, I still remember my mother making pie crust and getting that, the little, what do you call them, the little crumbs of like cornmeal.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, to just like working the butter in your hands until it's smaller chunks. Because you don't, with a dough like that, leaving the butter whole will actually give it that flaky consistency and texture. Because when you bake it, that butter is evaporating, and that's creating air, and then it just leaves behind open hollow spaces and that buttery flavor. And that's what gives you that flaky texture.
You know, when you're talking about dough for this book, you're talking about pastry dough. You're not talking about bread dough, although you do have brioche in it. And you're not talking about pasta dough, but you do have gnocchi in it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to focus on the sweet side of things. I've always had an affinity for desserts. And that on its own, bread is a dough in itself that just deserves its own book, because there are so many varieties. So I figured we'd stick to one kind of sweet dough, which can be made into pastries and bread dough, and that would be it.
Now, the interesting thing is that you're sort of living proof that people can conquer the making of dough, and hence the making of recipes made from dough. How did it happen? You said your first baking was with mud out of the garden, but it was just a little more complicated than that.
It really was. I always grew up in a family of sweet tooths, and so we kind of all enjoyed our baked goods, but none of my parents were adventurous bakers. They loved to cook, but baking was kind of outside their realm, or at least
that's
they thought.
Me.
Yeah, and so we didn't get to do much of it. And I think kind of as I grew up and as we all grew up, we started to want to try new things. And I know personally, I really just wanted to learn how to do these completely by hand and from scratch. It's something I love to do now, but at the time, I just wanted to know if it could be done and is it easy enough? And it kind of became a challenge to myself to push myself in the pastry world.
Now, you had a couple of good teachers too, though, right? There in Houston,
absolutely.
You had a couple of pastry chefs who were very helpful.
Yes, yeah, I've been working at a bakery, Fluff Bake Bar, here in town for a little over a year now, and I've just been so fortunate that the owner and pastry chef Rebecca and her Sue Kimberly have both just been an amazing help. Like anytime I have questions, they're always there to answer, and they've taught me so much of what I know now, and so much of what's ended up in the book.
Yeah, well, I mean, this book is a wealth of information, along with some of the more interesting recipes I've read in a good long while, but we'll get to that. I want you to explain your premise of ratios.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So because of the 12 doughs I have in this book,
You organize this by the chapters are different doughs, such as...
So we have everything from, like, biscuit and scone dough on to pie dough, and you have your short crust, sweet crust, and we jump all the way through choux, puff pastry, and tackle the more tough doughs like croissant, Danish, and phyllo dough.
Yeah, phyllo. I love that. You expect people to make phyllo dough. I mean, even Greeks don't make their own phyllo dough anymore.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's one of those lost arts, but it's a lot of fun. It's a fun dough, that's for sure.
So what is your ratio?
So the ratio is the relationship between the five main ingredients that you're going to find in almost every dough. It's the ratio between flour, sugar, your fat, which is usually going to be butter, a liquid, and then your eggs. And it's the difference in that ratio or the relationship between those numbers can mean wildly different doughs. It will just change so much about the dough itself. And I wanted to kind of show readers that it's a good way to understand the difference in applications using just the same ingredients.
You have like in each recipe, but you only have two numbers, 3 to 1.
It depends. If there's only two ingredients, then it's 3 to 1. I think that one's
a lot of them are 8 to 1, 3 to 1. I mean,
So when we get to our specific recipes, I break down the ratio of dough to filling ingredients. So one of my scones, it's a ratio of like 16 to 5, and that shows you that this dough can hold that much ingredients. That makes sense.
So that's not your basic ratio.
What you're doing there is saying don't put any more than this quantity of filling in, otherwise your end product won't be as successful.
Exactly. Yeah, I wanted to give the reader as much opportunity to make a recipe completely their own, and that's the goal.
Yeah, I have just one surprise after another reading what you write, such as, for example, you prefer butter to lard. Now, why is that? Because everybody now is on the lard bandwagon.
Yeah, absolutely. I just personally prefer butter because of the flavor. And I think it's a little easier just to keep one fat in the kitchen. It's really very versatile. Lard will do a great job at creating that flaky texture. But I just think it lacks that creaminess and that delicious flavor you get from butter.
And liquid, you prefer what?
Well, depending on the dough, it's usually going to be water or milk. You can use both interchangeably as well. Milk will just usually add just a little bit more flavor and give you kind of that characteristic dairy creaminess.
But you say it can kill your yeast.
Yes, so there are enzymes within the milk itself that if you're going to use in a yeast leavened dough, such as Danish or croissant, you'll want to kill those enzymes. And that's as simple as heating the milk to the scalding point before using it in the dough.
Huh. Well, now you've solved my problem. Peter said that he said scone, and I thought it was scone, but you say scone, so I guess scone is right.
That's it might just be a southern thing, too. I mean, that's the way I've always grown up hearing it.
Well, yeah, I mean, Americans tend to say scone, but I read someplace where the Scottish say scone.
Yes, I hear that too a lot with people that come into the shop. So I say either word works.
Right. Now, I mean, your stuff is interesting. I mean, what are some of your favorite sort of off the chart kinds of recipes?
Well, one of my favorites is my salted caramel eclairs, and they're actually topped with caramel popcorn.
Yeah, I saw that. I thought that was good.
Yeah, I got the inspiration when I was in Paris last year, actually. I went into a shop one morning, and they had these delicious salted caramel eclairs. It wasn't without the caramel popcorn on top, but I just love that flavor combination. So I wanted to see how could I take that, make it mine, and, you know, kind of throw in a little bit of an American twist with that caramel. Another favorite of mine is some of the savory recipes. I have a root vegetable spiral tart.
Oh, I wanted that one. I mean, I really would like to have that to try. Do I have to make it now?
It's a delicious one.
Pardon?
Yeah, carrots. It's very delicious. Carrots, parsnips, and rutabaga come together, and they just create such a wonderful flavor.
Now, root vegetables are Peter's strong point. Do you think you could make that, Rabbit?
I have no idea.
Oh, is it pretty, huh?
As long as you make the dough. I don't make dough.
I make terrible dough.
We can make that arrangement.
I was telling Anne that when I was in the Boy Scouts.
Oh, you tell them about this.
We went oven. We would have a camping contest. We would camp for 2 weeks, and everything we did was a contest. And one of the contests was baking a cake. Well, this is all very well, but it's a little more complicated when you think about the fact that you're not using a conventional oven. The only fuel you have is wood, and the only container you have is a biscuit box.
Yeah, you know, a tin, like you know, you keep cookies in and stuff. Tin.
Oh yes, yeah.
So we made a biscuit tin oven out of the cubic case of the biscuits, covered with mud.
Mud.
to keep the heat in.
Oh, that must have been a very interesting baking.
Made one hell of a good cake.
Oh, that may be the secret. Who knew?
Yeah, well, one of my favorite things is that I just think should be in everybody's repertoire for when you're entertaining, like, or a brunch, this cranberry pistachio braided brioche loaf.
Yes, that's one of my personal favorites in this book as well. I think with brioche, it's actually a relatively simple dough, and it's a great way to make any sort of loaf. And I love the brioche because you can make donuts with it, you can make cinnamon rolls, or you can make braided loaves here. And I think throwing in those cranberries and the pistachios in this case just give it such a unique and delicious flavor. And it's a perfect recipe for the holidays as well.
Okay. Yeah. Tell me why everybody is so nuts over cinnamon rolls. I mean, are we in some sort of a new high on cinnamon rolls? Because every I pick up at anything to read, it's featuring cinnamon rolls.
Yeah, I don't know if we say it's the next cupcake, but I think it's just one of those recipes that takes a lot of us back to childhood or kind of reminds us of different times, and it's just a very classic, simple recipe to make itself. So I think people just like to look towards it, and it's a great way to really change it up, too. You can do so many different things with cinnamon rolls because you can change the fillings and the doughs, the glazes. I think it gives home cooks a chance to really kind of make things their own.
Right. Yeah, on a savory note, I think that your croissant with the ham and cheese is pretty good, too.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's definitely a delicious way to start the day.
Well, there's so many in this book that I want. I would like to have some of these. I would like for you to make them for me. But you do
make that happen.
But you can explain them in this book, and you do explain them very deftly. So
well, good, and that's been the goal, because I just really want to show home cooks how easy it is to kind of tackle baking on their own. It doesn't have to be a scary subject.
Right. Well, but you make it clear. So, well, I wish you luck with this book. And
thank you very much.
Yeah, and here's to many more books and baking experiences. And thank you for taking the time to talk to us. And everybody should follow your, what is it, your blog again?
Yes, it's chasingdelicious.com.
I love the name, Chasing Delicious. Well, Russell Van Kranenburg, thank you again.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a blast.
And it's been a blast to have you join us on today's program, except for Anne, who really, you have to say, she absolutely soldiered on, and we congratulate her for that. But we'll relieve her of her usual duty of saying goodbye by saying goodbye. This is Peter saying goodbye, same time, same place next week, we hope.